The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're already at the last show of the week. It's Friday, and we just passed our one-year anniversary yesterday. Thank you for the emails that many of you sent in through the week. Keep sending those to td@kpcg.fm. Well, we're in the last year of President Obama's second term, and we're beginning to see all of these very detailed looks inside the White House, inside his administration, how he makes policy, what makes him tick, the people behind the president. You had the big profile in March in The Atlantic magazine where Jeffrey Goldberg spotlighted the president's thinking. And it was in that piece, as you may remember, where he criticized a number of America's allies, said a number of other things. On this program, about a month ago, we played a few clips from the BBC program. I think that ran in early April inside the Obama White House. And that, along with another report, this was from Fox News. You may recall we played a few clips from this report where it quoted it interviewed the previous defense secretaries underneath President Obama. And I'll just play a portion of one of those clips that we played earlier. This is former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel talking about the Obama White House.
On President Obama, he's one of the youngest presidents we've ever had, one of the most inexperienced presidents we've ever had. He has a staff around him that is very inexperienced. I don't think there's one veteran on his senior staff at the White House. I don't believe there's one business person. I don't believe there's one person who's ever run anything. Other than Vice President Biden, none of them have ever been elected to anything.
So here is a former defense secretary saying that the White House is very young and inexperienced, the staff that is, and how that these young, very inexperienced, very smart individuals are pretty much running the show. Yesterday, the New York Times had a piece on one of those top advisors, the 38-year-old deputy national security advisor, whose name is Ben Rhodes. And he's been called the boy wonder of the Obama White House, one of the president's closest advisors. He travels with him wherever he goes. He writes most of the president's speeches, at least all of the foreign policy speeches. He's been a Washington insider for a number of years, even though he's fairly young. His wife works at the State Department. His brother is the president of CBS News, so he's in big media, the brother. And Ben Rhodes is in the White House. And the title of the piece is The Aspiring Novelist Who Became Obama's Foreign Policy Guru. This is an article that's supposed to run. It's by David Samuels. It's supposed to run in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. That'll be in the newspaper edition. But it was posted just yesterday, May 5th. And it's quite a revealing article. It talks about how Ben Rhodes, as a young man in his early 20s, was in college there in New York the day that 9/11 happened. And in college, he had been pursuing a degree in creative writing, fiction writing. And he ended up getting that degree. But evidently, 9/11 had quite a profound experience on him, as after that, he decided he wanted to get into politics, or at least into international relations. Quoting from this piece, the New York Times Magazine piece, it says, he is, according to the consensus of the 24 current and former White House insiders I talked to, the single most influential voice shaping American foreign policy. aside from the president himself, a very influential advisor, a 38-year-old that specialized in creative writing, and he's working now on foreign policy for the Obama White House. This article says that he communicates with the president perhaps more than anyone else. It says, on the largest and smallest questions alike, the voice in which America speaks to the world is that of Ben Rhodes. When you hear the Obama White House, you hear a lot of phrases and statements that were penned by Ben Rhodes. The piece talks about just how he and Mr. Obama are, well, they just think exactly alike. He knows how the president thinks. And the president knows how Ben Rhodes writes. It says, like Obama, Rhodes is a storyteller who uses a writer's tools to advance an agenda that is packaged as politics, but is often quite personal. He's adept at constructing overarching arcing plot lines with heroes and villains, their conflicts and motivations supported by flurries of carefully chosen adjectives, quotations, and leaks from named and unnamed senior officials. He's the master shaper and retailer of Obama's foreign policy narratives at a time when the killer wave of social media has washed away the sandcastles of the traditional press. His ability to navigate and shape this new environment makes him a more effective and powerful extension of the president's will than any number of policy advisors or diplomats or spies. And then notice what it says here. His lack of conventional, real-world experience of the kind that normally precedes responsibility for the fate of nations, like military or diplomatic service or even a master's degree in international relations, rather than creative writing, is still startling. I mean, even the New York Times is startled by this. The New York Times, that carries water for this administration, is startled by the fact that one of the top foreign policy advisors has a master's degree in fiction. Fiction. And it's his job to write the narrative, not to report the facts necessarily, but to write the narrative. It gives an example in this piece about the State of the Union speech that the president gave back in January. It was the same day that Iran seized those two small boats full of the U.S. sailors. And so Rhodes' job on that day was to conceal the facts about what really happened there, or at least to delay it, so that it wouldn't interfere with the story that the president had to tell that night. To talk about how great relations with Iran are, and now with the deal, the nuke deal. You'll recall we discussed this on this program, what they were even saying the day or two after the president's speech about how that this was just an innocent mistake. Vice President Biden made statements, John Kerry made statements about it was just an innocent mistake by the sailors, and Iran was there to help them. And of course, as the facts rolled out, you began to see just how humiliating the whole incident was for the United States. The New York Times Review, it says here, watching Rhodes' work, I remember that he is still chiefly a writer who is using a new set of tools along with the traditional arts of narrative and spin to create stories of great consequence on the biggest page imaginable. The narratives he frames, the voices of senior officials, the columnists and reporters whose work he skillfully shapes and ventriloquizes, and even the president's own speeches and talking points are the only dots of color in a much larger vision about who Americans are and where we are going that Rhodes and the president have been formulating together over the past 7 years. When I asked Jon Favreau, Obama's lead speechwriter in the 2008 campaign and a close friend of Rhodes, whether he or Rhodes or the president had ever thought of their individual speeches and bits of policymaking as part of some larger restructuring of the American narrative, he replied, We saw that as our entire job. That's our entire job, to restructure the entire American narrative. They're here, these writers, these creative writers, these fiction writers, to tell a good story about President Obama's America, a colorful story, a lively story, a story where the world's just getting better and better because of Obama's policies, a story that says the world's safer, the world's tranquil, we're making peace with enemies that used to hate us. This one jumped out at me. It says, having recently, this is the author, David Samuels, having recently spent time working in Hollywood, I realize during our conversations that the role Rhodes plays in the White House bears less resemblance to any specific character on Beltway Insider TV shows like The West Wing or House of Cards than it does to the people who create those shows. And like most TV writers, Rhodes clearly prefers to imagine himself in the company of novelists. So he's not so much like one of the characters. He works in the West Wing, but he's not so much like one of the characters on the West Wing. He's like the producer or the screenwriter of the show. It's all like a reality TV show, except it's not really reality, the story they're writing. But it makes for good television. It's a great story to tell. This BBC series, Inside Obama's White House. I'm going to play for you a clip here. This is, I think I set it up last time. This was about a month ago, but I'm not sure we had the clip at the time. In any event, it's talking about how excited, and you'll hear a reference to Ben Rhodes in this particular clip, but it talks about how excited the White House was when Mubarak's regime was finally toppled and how they celebrated. Notice this from the BBC Two series.
We turned on Al Jazeera, and, you know, Ben Rhodes and other people at the White House came over, and we toasted that this was a good day. A lot of bad days came later, but that was a good day.
There are very few moments in our lives where we have the privilege to witness history taking place. This is one of those moments. This is one of those times. The people of Egypt have spoken. Their voices have been heard, and Egypt will never be the same.
This Arab Spring now swept across the region. In neighboring Libya, protesters rose up against a dictator who had ruled for more than 40 years.
When Obama came out and he did not protect Hosni Mubarak, that was very inspiring. There is glimpses of hope coming out that nobody is going to protect those dictators from the people.
Yeah, it was also very inspiring the day that it happened. And as that Fox report, where it quoted all those defense secretaries, pointed out, it was all the young advisors in the White House that insisted on Mubarak being pushed aside. And then you heard the president there in that clip talking about how it's such a great moment. We're witnessing history. He gave a speech, an inspiring speech written by Ben Rhodes. Egypt's never going to be the same. Well, he got that right. The whole region is never going to be the same. But somehow or another, as they continue to tell the story, whether it's Libya or on into Syria, it's all working out great now that the United States isn't meddling anymore. Or, well, if there are problems, it's carryover from Iraq, and that we shouldn't have been there in the first place, and that only made problems worse. So you can blame it on the previous administration. The New York Times piece says Rhodes had also developed a healthy contempt for the American foreign policy establishment, including editors and reporters at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker, and elsewhere. And then he goes on to say that it also included Hillary Clinton, Robert Gates, others who were Iraq war promoters. Just a healthy contempt. And the article says that Rhodes and Obama share this contempt for what they call the foreign policy establishment. And he got into that, the president did, in that Atlantic feature back in March with Jeffrey Goldberg. We're doing something altogether different. And what we ended up doing in Syria, by drawing the red line and then by not backing it up, it was actually a brilliant move on our part. I mean, we did something that no one in the foreign policy establishment thought that we'd do. Because they have a contempt, a healthy contempt, for those that might be experienced in that establishment. Now, many of those in the establishment are agenda-driven, too. But that's not the point. The point, as Lee Smith brings out at the Weekly Standard, is that the emotion driving the administration's foreign policy is contempt. Contempt. You have the contempt for allies. You have the contempt for colleagues. You have the contempt for the media. We'll see that more clearly in just a second. You have the contempt for American policymakers who for the last several generations have built up, as Lee Smith says, this post-World War II international order, which has given the globe a relative amount of stability and peace abroad and prosperity at home. All of that has since been dismantled. And now the world is falling apart, and America has gone missing. The New York Times Review, it says here, the job he was hired to do, namely to help the President of the United States communicate with the public, was changing in equally significant ways thanks to the impact of digital technologies. So, and you know about this administration coming in 2008. I mean, they really had the state-of-the-art technology. They had a staff, a younger staff, that really did exploit those technologies that were only beginning to explode onto the scene. Facebook, Twitter, social media, and all those things. It brought down old media in many ways. There have been lots of cuts, as it goes on to point out. It's hard for many to absorb the true magnitude of the change in the news business. 40% of newspaper industry professionals have lost their jobs over the past decade, in part because readers can absorb all the news they want from social media platforms. It says you have to have skin in the game to be in the news business or depend in a life or death way on its products to understand the radical and qualitative ways in which more words that appear in familiar typefaces have changed. Rose singled out a key example to me one day, laced with the brutal contempt that is a hallmark of his private utterances. And this quotes Rose. Rhodes is saying, all these newspapers used to have foreign bureaus. Now they don't. They call us to explain to them what's happening in Moscow and Cairo. Most of the outlets are reporting on world events from Washington. The average reporter we talk to is 27 years old, and their only reporting experience consists of being around political campaigns. That's a sea change. They literally know nothing. That's what Ben Rhodes thinks of the Washington press. To them, I mean, and this is an administration, keep in mind, that the press defends and supports. And yet to those on the inside of the White House, many of the members of the media are just seen as useful idiots. 27-year-olds who really don't know much of anything about international relations. Well, I mean, I'm not going to argue with that. They are living in a bubble. They are writing about world events from their tiny little cubicle in some building in Washington, D.C. or New York. That's pretty much where all of the journalists reside. And as he brings out rather proudly, the White House has become quite good at manipulating them. At telling a good, colorful, creative story. Fiction! It says, in this environment, Rhodes has become adept at ventriloquizing many people at once. Ned Price, Rhodes' assistant, gave me a primer on how it's done. The easiest way for the White House to shape the news, he explained, is from the briefing podiums, each of which has its own dedicated press corps. But then there are sort of these force multipliers, he said, adding, we have our compadres. I'll reach out to a couple of people. I mean, they know who to go to, and they know which ones are going to just sound the party line and get on their tools and spread the message. And they can do it quickly. And really the most stunning aspect of this article is how the administration sold the Iranian nuke deal. That's not my word. That's their word. That's the New York Times word. How they sold the deal. It says Rhodes is innovative. Notice the words used in this next paragraph. Rhodes' innovative campaign to sell the Iran deal is likely to be a model for how future administrations explain foreign policy to Congress and the public. The way in which most Americans have heard the story of the Iran deal presented, that the Obama administration began seriously engaging with the Iranian officials in 2013 in order to take advantage of a new political reality in Iran, which came about because of elections that brought moderates to power, well, so-called moderates to power in that country. And then the Times Review here says that was largely manufactured for the purpose for selling the deal. That was a manufactured story. That was fiction. They were negotiating with Iran before the changeover in 2013. In fact, as we've covered before on this program, President Obama came into office with that foremost in his mind. He was going to reach out to Iran. He was going to reach out to the mullahs. And there were back-channel discussions going on early on, certainly in 2012, as has now been widely reported, a full year and a half before we get to this narrative, written by the creative writer with the master's degree in fiction. It says, even where the particulars out of that story are true, this is the New York Times writing about the narrative that Ben Rhodes wrote on the Iran nuke deal. Even where the particulars of that story are true, the implications that readers and viewers are encouraged to take away from those particulars are often misleading or false. I mean, listen, we're talking about a nuclear deal that if it doesn't go well, an entire city can be blown off the map. And yet, they're treating this like it's a game. Well, here's how we can manufacture the facts. Here's how we can sell the story. It says Obama's closest advisors always understood him to be eager to do a deal with Iran as far back as 2012, and even since the beginning of his presidency. They always knew. His closest advisors always knew that this was his intent from the very beginning. But then when Rouhani finally got in there in 2013, well, they had an opportunity to tell a story that would help to sell the deal. I mean, this is good politics. The New York Times Review here says this is likely to be a model for how future administrations explain foreign policy to Congress or to the general public. This is likely to be the model that the next president uses as he surrounds himself with some good fiction writers. That's all you need. It says in the narrative that Rhodes shaped, again, these are the New York Times words, in the narrative that Rhodes shaped, the story, quote unquote, of the Iran deal began in 2013 when a moderate, quote unquote, faction inside the Iranian regime led by Hassan Rouhani beat regime hardliners, quote unquote, in an election that then began to pursue a policy of openness, quote unquote. Now they're open to negotiations. Now there's a new administration. Now we've got an opportunity. Well, we have to take advantage of this. I mean, they're reaching out to us. We have to respond. It says, which included a newfound willingness to negotiate the dismantling of its illicit nuclear weapons program. The president set out the timeline himself in his speech announcing the nuclear deal on July 14th, 2015. This quotes the president, giving a speech written by Ben Rhodes, no doubt. Today, he said, July 14th, 2015, today, after 2 years of negotiations, the United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not. And then the Times says, while the president's statement was technically accurate, there had in fact been 2 years of formal negotiations leading up to the signing of the JCPOA. It was also actively misleading because the most meaningful part of the negotiations with Iran had begun in mid-2012, many months before Rouhani and the so-called moderate camp were chosen in an election among candidates handpicked by Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The idea that there was a new reality in Iran was politically useful to the Obama administration. See, it's all politics. Here's something that happens that, hey, that can be politically useful to us. We can go out and start telling people that Rouhani's much more moderate than his predecessor. And then we can get what we've always wanted from the start. And then this. It says, as Malley and the representatives of the State Department, including Wendy Sherman and Secretary of State John Kerry, engaged in formal negotiations with the Iranians to ratify details of a framework that had already been agreed upon, these were the ones doing the actual negotiations. And then there was Rhodes' war room working behind the scenes. It says, Rhodes' war room did its work on Capitol Hill and with reporters. In the spring of last year, legions of arms control experts began popping up at think tanks and on social media and then became key sources for hundreds of often clueless reporters. And then it quotes Ben Rhodes, "We created an echo chamber. We created this. We created an echo chamber," he admitted. When I asked him to explain the onslaught of freshly minted experts cheerleading for the deal, it quotes Rhodes as saying this, they were saying things that validated what we had given them to say. So there you go. They sent out the experts, legions of them, and then the clueless reporters took what they said and spread it around the world. And now Ben Rhodes proudly admits, he's bragging to the New York Times. Yeah, we manipulated the press. Yeah, we created this narrative to sell it. We even unleashed all of this legion of arms control experts. It validated what we had given them to say. They were saying things that validated what we had given them to say. I mean, it's really unbelievable, isn't it, how corrupt this is. He says, we had the test drives to know who was going to be able to carry our message effectively and how to use outside groups like Plowshares and Iran Project and whomever else. So we knew the tactics that worked. And then the Times says he's proud of the way he sold the Iran deal. And then it quotes Ben Rhodes, we drove them crazy, them being the opponents of the deal. Those who would criticize the deal, we drove them crazy. They spread all these lies. And now he's there patting himself on the back, saying, we drove the critics crazy. It's interesting, the Times asked him, well, okay, and before, as I gave you that quote previously, this is the model now that others are going to come in and use. The Times says now, you know, what are you going to think when a different administration with a different agenda comes in using this same approach? And, well, the thought of that, it scares Ben Rhodes. It scares him to think about what a more conservative administration. I mean, in that scenario, of course it's wrong. Of course it shouldn't be done. Of course it's scary. Of course it's dangerous. But as long as it fits within his narrow agenda, well, the end justifies the means. This article concludes with an interview. It's a long article. I didn't get the word count, but I printed it out. It's about 12 pages. But it quotes the former Defense Secretary Panetta there at the end. And while these negotiations were going on, one of Panetta's jobs was to reassure Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and his defense minister, Ehud Barak. He was trying to keep them from launching a preemptive attack, assuring them that President Obama had their back. That if we caught wind that they started to develop a nuclear weapon, the United States would intervene and put a stop to it. And all along, according to this article, Netanyahu and Barak were saying to Panetta, is President Obama serious, though? I mean, will he really stop it? And Panetta assured them, yes, he will. Yes, he will. Well, knowing what we know now about all of these inside the White House reports here in the last year of President Obama's administration, the Times asked Mr. Panetta, well, would you make that same assessment today? Would you tell or reassure your allies in Israel that the United States would intervene and that President Obama is in fact serious about intervening? And Panetta's response, probably not. Probably not. He wasn't really serious. They could tell a good story. It could be colorful and vivid and lively. But they're not going to let the facts get in the way of that narrative. At the Weekly Standard, Lee Smith says, for the last 7 years, the American public has been, he's commenting on this piece that will be printed in the New York Times Review on Sunday. He says, for the last 7 years, the American public has been living through a postmodern narrative crafted by an extremely gifted and unspeakably cynical political operative whose job is to wage digital information campaigns designed to dismantle a several decade-old security architecture while lying about the nature of the Iranian regime. No wonder Americans feel less safe. They are. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. And the live stream's available at the trumpet.com website and also kpcg.fm, both of our websites. Don't forget to send us your emails through the weekend. You can send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Well, also in the news, quite a lot in the news this past week. Not just this past week, really, for the past 11 months, the Donald Trump phenomenon. And there have been quite a few columns about him and his victory on Tuesday and winning the nomination for the Republican Party. Charles Krauthammer yesterday asked what lies beyond, or rather behind, the Trump victory, the nomination victory. And he says here, received wisdom among conservatives is that he, the outsider, sensed, marshaled, and came to represent a massive revolt of the Republican rank and file against the establishment. This is the narrative. GOP political leaders made promises of all kinds and received in return during President Obama's years, major electoral victories that gave them the House, the Senate, 12 new governorships, and 30 state houses, yet they didn't deliver. Exit polls consistently show that a majority of GOP primary voters, 60% in some states, feel betrayed by their leaders. Not just let down or disappointed, betrayed. Betrayed by rhinos who, corrupted by donors and lobbyists, sold out. Did they repeal Obamacare? No. Did they defund Planned Parenthood? No. Did they stop President Obama's tax and spend hyper-liberalism? No. Whether from incompetence or venality, says they let Obama walk all over them. And then he says here, but then comes the paradox. If insufficient resistance to Obama's liberalism created this sense of betrayal, why in a field of 17 did Republican voters choose the least conservative candidate? That's a good question. Why? I mean, if this is the conventional wisdom, if so many people are upset, if so many feel betrayed because of all of these actions, conservative actions that weren't carried out, then why did they elect the most liberal among the 17? Well, over at National Review, David French, I think, had some, he drew some pretty good conclusions about Donald Trump and whether or not he's a creation of the media or whether the media is just following after him. French here says, this is from May 3rd, I'd argue that Trump took advantage of pre-existing trends that made it virtually inevitable that he'd not only dominate media coverage from the start, but he'd enjoy immense advantages throughout the race. And then French writes, First, pop culture is American culture. Politics is a subculture. This means that even the most prominent of senators and governors typically have to spend enormous sums of money introducing themselves to the American people. Well, and he's saying that Trump didn't have to do this. Everybody knew him. I mean, he's got 100% name recognition. But in the traditional scenario, a politician has to get out there, raise all the money, and try to get his name out there. Try to come out of obscurity. And avoid making a gaffe or a mistake that will kill your campaign. It says, in this context, gaffes are often fatal, and negative advertising is so effective because the mistake or scandal comes to define the candidate. We saw this reality in the 2012 race. Despite the fact that Mitt Romney had been running for president off and on since 2006, he didn't break out of the subculture until he had virtually clinched the nomination. For most Americans, he was a blank slate, and thus Democrats could successfully brand one of the most decent and kind individuals in American politics as a malevolent version of Gordon Gekko, willing to literally kill people to make a buck. That's what happened in the 2012 cycle. But this time around, it is different. And it's fascinating to watch. And it's not going to turn out good, as we said the other day and last week on the program, Is Donald Trump the Answer? It says, but what if a megawatt celebrity runs for president, a person that tens of millions of Americans have known for decades? We tend to forget how long Trump has been famous. The Art of the Deal came out in 1987. During the Reagan administration. How many movie stars have stayed prominent for three decades? He had all the business deals. He had The Art of the Deal, the book, come out in 87. He had his show, The Apprentice. I think that was on TV for 14 years. How many TV programs have been around for 14 years? Trump was more famous than any single person in political media, including all the major talk radio hosts, so his gaffes couldn't define him. His outrageous statements couldn't sink his campaign. Indeed, the gaffes often stayed in the political subculture, while Trump remained the dominant force in the much larger pop culture. Call Trump racist, and Apprentice fans immediately compare the accusation with the man they watched for 14 seasons. You call Trump stupid, and they remember his decades-long reign as one of America's most famous billionaires. People just tune it out. People hear someone comment on all of the liberal policies, the liberal thinking, the fact that he's a liberal Democrat, much like Hillary Clinton. And it doesn't bother them. They're not in the political subculture. They're in the mainstream. They're in popular culture. That's the point that he's making here. The great tragedy of Trump's Republican establishment is that unlike mainstream media outlets, they are built from the ground up to chase ratings. These conservative institutions, he has conservative in quotes, and individuals were allegedly built around principles. Yes, they wanted eyeballs and page views, but until this presidential race, many of them took great pride in their ability to attract an audience through the force of their ideas and the strength of their convictions. Indeed, these individuals and institutions used to pride themselves on policing the conservative movement, on calling out the rhinos, and the moderates in our midst. The rhinos are the the so-called Republicans in name only. It says that all seems hollow now. The pot of audience gold shines just as brightly for Breitbart as it does for NBC and CBS. Yes, indeed, it does. Let me just play for you what... This is an exchange that happened on Fox News yesterday or the day before. I forget the name of the presenter that's asking the question, but the one responding to it is Chris Wallace. And I mean, this is no 27-year-old journalist that doesn't know anything about the world. He's been around for quite some time, and he hosts the Sunday morning talk show. I forget the name of that as well, but it's on Sunday mornings on Fox. And here's what he said.
A broader question about the campaign itself, a chicken or the egg question. Did the Trump support drive the media, or did the media drive the Trump support by diminishing real estate for other candidates?
Now, I get asked this question a lot. I have to say, I think to a certain degree it became a vicious or virtuous cycle, depending on how you view the Trump campaign. But I think we were followers, not leaders in this. In other words, I think that the reason we put them on so much, and I think we did, all of us, whether it was cable, whether it was broadcast, all of us put them on too much. I think to a large degree it was because every time we did, it spiked the ratings. We were, in a sense, following what the ratings were, which was the response of the public. Having said that, the fact that we put them on so much, it did crowd out, take a lot of the oxygen away from the other candidates. But I think at least the initial impulse was, you know, if you put them on, you get ratings, and we're in the news business.
That's an astounding admission. Coming a day or two after he won the nomination. Look, we did put him on a lot. We put him on too much. We crowded the others out. And we did it for ratings. We did it for ratings. Because after all, this is business. This is business. And so, as I talked about yesterday, you remember the clip where all of these reporters, we're waiting now for Donald. Anytime Donald Trump's coming up live, in just a few moments. In one of those cases, there was a live program. You couldn't see this on the YouTube clip because we just played the audio yesterday or the day before. But there's a live program going on where the host waited for 40 minutes. And then just kept filling up the time with this item or this item. Okay, hang on. Well, no, he's not up. Okay, hang on. Oh, here he comes. Here he comes now. 40 minutes to see what one candidate, one, as this article brings out, one of 17. At least that's what it was initially. And then we get a very open and candid admission there from one of the senior journalists at Fox News. Well, the reason we put him on repeatedly is we kept getting a spike in the ratings. CNN would say the same thing. MSNBC, CBS, ABC, NBC. They want to get eyeballs. They want to get page views. And so that's what it boils down to. Don't these examples, whether you take these articles we're going through here in this segment, or the one from the New York Times Review, they demonstrate just how shallow the major media really and truly is. How little they understand what's going on in the world. How easy it is for them to be manipulated. For them to tell things that are complete lies. Total fabrications, or to leave out essential points that leave viewers walking away from it with a false impression. It's frightening, isn't it? It really is. They're cheering along, like I said yesterday, or the day before. They're cheering along. They've got their man, and of course it's interesting, all the theories you listen to now, because of course every single cycle the media is 99% on board with the one coming out of the Democrat Party. But this time around, I mean, with so many eyeballs to get from interviews with Donald Trump, with a spike in the ratings, I mean, if this continues, it'll just be interesting to see how the media react. Particularly, well, you know where Fox and those kinds will stay. I mean, they're going to stay right there with Trump. But it will be interesting to watch what the others have to say. And if they do, as some have suggested, gang up on Trump. They've been holding back. They've got all of the dirt. They're going to throw everything out there. Now that they know it's these two, they're going to do everything they can to bring down Trump in support of Hillary Clinton. But like French brings out in this article, will anything stick? Because in popular culture, this is a man who, for three decades, has been very popular. Very popular. Oh, he'll be attacked, as will Hillary. They'll both be attacked in the political subculture. In the end, of course, what will happen is what will best fulfill God's purpose. That's what we know. And that's why we don't have to get too worked up about any of this back and forth. It feels good, doesn't it? Now you hear about never Trump or never Hillary. But it feels good knowing what God's people know. To be never Trump, never Hillary, never Sanders, never Cruz, never Kasich. And you could go right down the line. Never, 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 never. There's no hope in man. Jesus Christ is the answer. Always Christ. Just to finish the point here from French's article, it says, yes, there are people who are truly outraged by Trump, but they're often the people prone to dislike him anyway. As the litany of gaffes, distortions, and lies make its way into the wider culture, these natural opponents grow ever more hardened in their opposition. His base, however, remains immune. While many of his supporters truly don't care about his lies and feed off his arrogance and offensiveness, there are others who aren't prone to support those values and may well abandon Trump if they truly believe the accusations or if they believed any other politician was better. When they've been loudly told that virtually every other politician is a liar and a buffoon, why would they leave Trump? Well, this is just politics as usual. It's just the way it operates. I mean, in the New York Times Review yesterday, you have a senior White House advisor, the foreign policy guru of the White House, bragging that we lied to you about Iran and the nuke deal. And so what? You're stupid. You're a bunch of idiots. You're 27-year-olds who don't know anything. French concludes here, it's easy to blame the media for Trump's rise. And the media certainly helped. But Trump was the prime mover here. And he found a huge voting block that was ready to be moved. As one of America's most enduring celebrities, as a pioneer in reality television, and as a man who's made a lavish living off his larger-than-life personality, Trump isn't just using a greedy media. He's exploiting the very world he helped make. He, like the White House, is quite good at exploiting the very world that he helped to make. It's all like a big reality TV show, you see. It's all about the narrative. It's all about the narrative in popular culture. Not some subculture for, you know, a few political junkies. But what's the story that we can tell? What's the slogan that we can put out there? What can we say that everyone, the majority, will rally around? It all makes for wonderful TV. It all makes for wonderful fiction. It makes for a great novel. But then you have to look at the real world, don't you? You can see why Jesus said we better be watching and praying. Watch world events and pray for guidance as you do so that you can see what's happening. Now, we can all be grateful that there's the trumpet.com on the internet and KPCG and the Trumpet magazine and so on so that we can have our eyes opened to what's happening in the world today. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we put the finishing touches on yet another week of broadcasting here at KPCG, I should say, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at thetrumpet.com. This weekend, send us an email. Send that to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week. And we'll see you Monday.